You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hey everyone, it's Sam Hankin. You're listening to the Avid Reader here on WCHE and streaming at WCHE1520.com. Today's broadcast is kind of a special one. We got two shows that you'll hear in succession. The first one's going to be Ransom Riggs, who's author of the new book, Hollow City, which is a sequel to Miss Peregrine's School for Peculiar Children. That book is going to be a movie directed by Tim Burton out next year. But Hollow City, you'll be listening to Ransom talking about that. And the reason I doubled these shows up is because Ransom's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library, and it's a free talk. He'll also be signing his new book, which is Hollow City. So then after the conclusion of that show, we're going to be interviewing Sue Monk Kidd, author of The Secret Life of Bees, which most of you will remember. Great book. It was produced on stage. In addition to that and the vast readership, it was adapted into a hit movie. Sue's new book is The Invention of Wings, which was just released this January, and the first selection for Oprah's new book club, Oprah 2.0. In any event, Sue will be talking about The Invention of Wings, and the first show, as I said, will be Ransom Riggs. So get ready to listen to, and Sue will be appearing tomorrow night at the Free Library. And I think it's $15 tickets at the door for her presentation. So without further ado, let's start the first of these two shows, which will be Ransom Riggs, and immediately following will be Sue Monk Kidd talking about her new book, The Invention of Wings. Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're happy to have with us Ransom Riggs, author of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, a book that's kind of classified, and Ransom's been here before and nice enough to come again. It's been classified as young adult fiction, but it's now cherished by, you know, as they say, folks from 8 to 80. In fact, Quirk Books says that the number of books has sold, kind of kidding around, is twice the height of Mount Everest, but not as cold. and now his new book, following on the heels of Miss Peregrine, is Hollow City. It's the second of what is now the Peregrine trilogy. And on top of all that, Miss Peregrine is now in production as a movie directed by Tim Burton. It's due for release in 2015. And since it's Tim Burton, you might also surmise that perhaps Johnny Depp or Helen Bonham Carter, who is definitely quirky, weird, peculiar. And since he loves them and they're in a lot of his movies, you know, that's a possibility. And there certainly are parts that fit them. So welcome, Ransom, and thanks again for coming and talking to us another time.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
When last we spoke, just after the book came out, you were like a regular guy. Now you're like a household name, soon to become a gazillionaire with, you know, probably two sequel films coming out. So how did this feel to you, this massive change that occurred between the publication of Miss Peregrine and where it is now?
Well, I'm still just a regular guy.
I'm just kidding.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm known among people who read lots of books, especially YA books, but still nobody knows who I am in LA, and I find that very comforting, actually.
Good.
So,
yeah.
You know, the change has been big, but not as massive as you would think. It sort of crept up on me. You know, the first book came out, it was kind of quiet, and it grew very slowly, you know, just in little dribs and drabs, and finally here we are. It's interesting. I'm still getting my head around it. Right now I'm on book tour and coming to Philadelphia, and this is the first sort of real 2-week long different city everyday book tour I've been on. So I'm just starting to get used to the whirlwind.
Yeah, you'll be in Philadelphia, I think, on the 27th. Something like that. I know.
Okay.
I don't know when you'll be exactly. I know you're going to be at the Free Library. I have the...
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
My schedule is...
I can imagine.
I know that that's locked down, but at it too hard, it makes me dizzy. So,
well, you think about it, though. I mean, the hardback came out in June of 2011, so like you said, it's a couple of years ago. And we talked right after, and then the paperback came out in like May of 12, and now Hollow City, which people have been clamoring for, and you know, you look at the boards, and it's why hasn't he finished writing it? It's like Game of Thrones, you know.
And so now that's out. But if you look at the indie bestseller list today or the New York Times bestseller list, in indie, you're under children's books. In the New York Times, you're under young adult. One of the things we talked about last time was, you know, it's just like The Hunger Games and those kinds of books, or even Harry Potter. You have as much of an adult readership, if not more, than you do of children and young adults, don't you think?
You know, it's hard because my only gauge of measurement for things like that is who contacts me and who comes to my book signings. And, you know, it's not like they take your age and your social security number at the bookstore, so I don't exactly know. Definitely hear more from young people on the internet, but that might just be because more young people are on the internet. My book signings are more younger folk than adults, but not by a large margin. So, yeah, it's pretty spread out. It's really interesting that way.
Well, I think when it becomes a film, and I'm sure it'll be very successful, I think you're going to have mostly an adult audience. And we did talk about this because at my bookstore when it first came out, we didn't put it in the young adult. We put it in fiction right on the front table. And in fact, today I was talking to my manager, and we moved both of them back to the front table, the paperback and the new one. And I think that's where they'll do best, at least for the time being. But I mean, you know, to be on both of these bestseller lists for as long as you have, it's amazing. And also, it was really nice of you on your website. Now, you gave yourself a post office box, and you say you're looking forward to receiving mail. Not that you can answer everything.
Yeah, people like to send me snapshots and things, so you can't do it over email.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, you know, you have kind of one is a second. Oh yeah, and the trailers for the book are really, really good. Did you do those on your own or?
Oh, thanks. I did the trailer for the first novel, but I didn't do these three for the second one. Very talented fellow named Zach out of Mississippi who is a director and does all the effects himself, and pretty amazing.
Yeah, especially with like Hugh and the bees. That was really well done.
Yeah, I was blown away. I mean, I, you know, wrote the thing, but I was like, yeah, you know, you see London burning in the background and bees are flying up in the circular formation in the sky, and I just assumed I would turn in this script and they would laugh at me and be like, we're not a Hollywood studio. But then they did it.
They did it. It's just as good. And it's funny because in Miss Peregrine, you have your epigraph about death, and you even talk about that in one of the trailers, and you read it by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who is also a character now. And it's a book, I think I told you then that I like reading epigraphs because I think it kind of, wrong word, but it kind of telegraphs or gives an idea of the spiritual aspect of the author's feeling about the book. And, you know, it's interesting to me because the first epigraph talks about death and how death is kind of ephemeral, and even though we think something's gone, it almost turns into something else, and we can never tie it down. Or as Emerson says, it's we can't moor it, and then it becomes a fable, and then in this one your epigraph is from Dante's Inferno and much more daunting. And what's really funny about the epigraph is the first part of it is about a boat coming to a dock or a shore, and that's where Emerson's epigraph leaves off, as something being unmoored, and then this thing comes to you.
True, actually. I didn't quite catch that, but it's funny how these little sort of serendipity things fall into place.
I know. I think
without even meaning them to.
I don't know. I think you probably did. You just, you know, it's way down deep in there. But it's interesting because, you know, you feel in the book, you know, okay, everything is at loose ends. People that are gone aren't really gone. In fact, you have a character that can reanimate those people. And then in the second, the second epigraph from Dante's Inferno is about a boat with a ferryman coming to take all the dead people, and he's telling the one live guy, get out of the way, kind of being nice. And of course in Dante, you know, with Virgil as his guide, Dante's going into the circles of hell, and he wants to see what's going on. So with me being long-winded and all, if you could tell us, you know, how you decided to use that as your epigraph.
Well, I was just casting around for things after I'd finished the book, and I ran across that. I'd taken a class on Dante's Inferno and Divine Comedy in college that was really just blew me away, and I had a lot of notes. And I ran across that epigraph, and it just sounded like the story I'd told in many ways. So when you read Hollow City, I think you'll see some mirroring in that epigraph with the motion of the plot.
Yeah, you definitely do. When we first talked and we talked about a sequel, I can't remember what you said at the very beginning. Had you already decided at that point, or were you just in the formative stages of deciding whether it was going to be a trilogy?
It took a long time to figure out what the book would be. I wanted to do a book right away, but we didn't settle on actually doing it for a little while after the book came out. When I wrote the first book, I wasn't certain I'd be allowed to do a second book, or if it would do well enough, or, you know, if I was just going to go back to writing screenplays or what. So I tried to leave the door open at the end of the first book in case I was able to write a second one. But I didn't really know what was going to happen.
Do you know what's going to happen in the third one?
Yes.
I won't ask any questions. It's funny. Well, also,
no spoilers, Sam.
It's funny too because there's a graphic novel version of Miss Peregrine now, right?
Yes, there is. Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how that came about?
Well, I can't draw. I didn't do it. We were approached by Yen Press, who does a lot. They do a lot of great graphic novels, especially YA books. They did a really nice adaptation of, for instance, the Beautiful Creatures books.
Oh yeah.
By the same artist, Cassandra Jean, and they said they wanted to do an adaptation. They showed us some samples of their art. We said that looks great, and they just sort of went off and did it. They adapted it kind of like you'd adapt a movie, you know, truncated it and chose certain scenes over others and made it wonderful. So I didn't have a lot to do with the creation of it. I just sort of approved things as they went along, but I think it's really beautifully done, and I think it's fascinating how they worked in the actual photographs into the narrative.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's graphic in a multi-level sense. I mean, your novel and its sequels are informed, even though I don't like that word, but they're informed by the photographs you have in there. And the first book, as you said, I think in one of the interviews, the first book you had these photographs and they kind of fit into and helped you decide which way you were going. But in the second book, since you knew what you were doing, it must have been a lot harder and a lot more work to find the photographs that you thought would fit into the plot, right?
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of momentum already in the plot, so I couldn't fit, you know, I couldn't just write any story to fit the photos that I had. I had to go out and look for specific photos, which was definitely more challenging. But by that time, I had a lot more photos than I had when I was writing book one. So, you know, my library of possibilities was larger, too. It was a very different process.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the longer trailer, you know, there's a scene of you at a flea market, and you talk about how these photos are 25 or 50 cents. But what's most poignant, you know, and almost brought tears to my eyes, is, you know, you have all these pictures, and you say sometimes, you know, you don't know the history. You don't know the story behind the picture. But that's why you always look at the back of them. And then you have all these ones that are either soldiers or couples together, and then you turn the back over, and it says killed in action, or they would have been married, or something like that. And it's mm-hmm. so heart-wrenching, isn't it? And it must be for you, too.
When you find a good one, a lot of them don't have writing on them. Some do. Most of that writing isn't very descriptive, but once in a while you'll find a photo with some writing on it that's just really, you know, raw, confessional, and just heartbreaking. And that was where my book, Talking Pictures, came from. It's a coffee table book with just photos with writing on them. So that's what that trailer was for, actually, although it's not explicit.
There's a good new photo book out called Humans of New York. Have you heard of that?
I've seen it around, yeah.
It's really cool because it's really good pictures of just everybody you see in New York, which many of them are peculiar. And but what he does is he writes underneath what they said, what they're saying as he takes their photograph. And it's fascinating because there's all kinds of stories, and it's just a very, I didn't expect it to be as interesting. The pictures are beautiful, but I didn't expect it to be as interesting as it was with regard to what the people are talking about.
Yeah, I think that came from a blog or something.
Yeah, it did. You're right. Someone else told me that too. Yeah, you're exactly right. I didn't know that.
I'll check that out. It looks really cool.
Yeah, it's really good. So what do you think about the movie? Do you have anybody in mind in your head, or you don't want to tell me?
they're not casting yet. It's too early, and the trouble is most of the characters are young, and I don't know that many actors under the age of 18. Also, I always feel a little bad sort of like dream casting the movie because if they pick, you know, and telling people about it because then if they pick different people than the ones I mentioned, you know, maybe they'll think that I didn't want them or something, or I'm disappointed. But I'm not. It'll be great.
Well, the thing that's funny about it is Johnny Depp can turn into anybody he wants, even including Tonto, kind of. But Helen Bonham Carter, you could take a picture of her and put it in your book right now. I mean, she has, like, the perfect look.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I love her. She's great.
I know. Well, even, like, in Harry Potter, I mean, yeah, she's just perfect for it. But
Bellatrix Lestrange is perfect.
Yeah, I know. She could just pop out of one frame into another, which is kind of... Well, so when you gather these photographs and now with the graphic novel and all that, is there any... I don't know. I mean, you venture into different areas, obviously, with the collecting of the photographs. And you're also a filmmaker, too. And in one of the interviews or on one of your pages, you talk about the fact that, you know, wow, you know, I do movies, too. But then again, having Tim Burton direct one of my movies is like a dream come true.
So yeah, absolutely. I've loved him since I was a kid. Always been one of my favorite directors, so I'm still pinching myself. I can't believe that, you know, he's even read my book.
It's perfect for him. If you think of even things like Coraline, or at first, you know, when they first said it, I was thinking, I wonder if this is going to be live action, or if I wondered if they're going to animate it. I didn't know. It's the first thing I heard. Is there a part of you, even though it's great that he's doing it, is there a part of you that would like to try to do it on your own? If you had the resources.
You know, I'm so close to the story that I don't think that I'd be the best person to adapt it, because to make a book into a movie, you have to change it in all these fundamental ways, and it's almost too painful. It's like doing surgery on your own child or something, you know?
That's true. You have
to hire a professional who's unrelated to the child to do it.
Yeah. You have to look at a screenplay and live with it, I guess, because there is a screenplay.
Yeah, there is. I read a draft a while ago, and it's really, really brilliant.
That's great. I think definitely it's going to do really well. You know, and that's what I was saying about adults. It's like me seeing The Hunger Games. You know, and primarily because I love Jennifer Lawrence because she's so hilarious. Can you realize? You know, she's 23. Peter O'Toole never won an Oscar. She won one last year for Best Actress, and she'll probably win one this year at the age of 23.
Oh, well, there's no accounting for taste.
Excuse me?
Kubrick never won an Oscar either.
Well, maybe you'll win one now.
But, Stanley Kubrick?
No, you.
Oh, for what? Nah.
I don't know. Best original book from which a screenplay was written or something.
I wish that were a category.
No, well, you know, Stanley Kubrick, like, I only know one other person who really liked Eyes Wide Shut. Did you like it?
You know, I need to rewatch it. I haven't seen it since just after it came out, and it got so maligned, but I think it's probably a really interesting movie that I've judged too quickly.
Yeah, it is, and it's from an old book that because I own a bookstore, so it's from an old book that I knew and I found, and he had obviously found it as well. And it's you know, it's a lot like The Magist too by John Fowles. But yeah, I think it's well worth watching again. Although I still don't know anybody but my ex-wife who liked it as well as I did. But that was one of the few unions. So after the third one comes out, is there going to, some of the people on all the boards are, you know, like I said, complain, why is he taking so long? Why is he taking so long to bring this book to fruition? Do you ever respond to them or talk about that with them?
Books are hard.
Yeah. I'm surprised you did it as quickly as you did.
I don't know. People talk to me on Twitter and, you know, ask me when the book's coming out and, you know, that's okay. Like, that just, I'm glad people care. And people are usually very polite, and it just, you know, it's motivating, not discouraging.
No, that's good. So when you decide, in the first book and now, you know, you have a kind of a two worlds, you know, you have a peculiar world with peculiar people, and then you have a kind of normal world with normal people. And I know this has been asked of you too, but choosing London as the peculiar city, what gave rise to that, especially since you're not from there?
Mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by London. I wrote a whole book on Sherlock Holmes, and because it's a story about time travel, I knew that I didn't need to make them go, you know, globetrotting to see the peculiar world. I just had to send them to a place that had a lot of rich history, and London is certainly that place.
Yeah, it's are you from the South originally? I've forgotten.
I grew up in Florida, so more like the tropics.
Yeah, and I spent like 20 years in Gainesville. I went to the University of Florida. Where were you located?
Oh, okay. I was near Sarasota.
Okay. So the first scene of the book, which, you know, doesn't contain really any spoilers, it kind of, you pick up exactly where you left off. And I think your fan base has no problem with this, but, and, you know, because you included a portion of the book at the end of the new edition, but did you ever think, well, maybe I should do one of those what has come before kind of things?
What do you mean?
You know, like a summary at the beginning of the book of, you know, I mean, did you worry about the fact that the second book is not standalone, and you can't read the second book without having really read the first book well? And sometimes that's difficult for people. You know, it eliminates a portion of your audience.
I thought that was the case, but there's been a number of people who, like, even, I don't know, newspaper reviewers and stuff, who read the second book without ever having read the first, and they claimed they weren't confused.
Really?
Well, that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I don't know either.
It's kind of weird. So I guess just think of the first book as a prequel.
Yeah, right, like Star Wars, episodes 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I suppose you could read The Two Towers before The Fellowship of the Ring, but I don't know. It would be difficult.
Yeah. I don't know. But I didn't mean for it to be confusing. But it picks up right where it left off, so there's not a lot of time to go back and
revisit.
The action takes place in both books over a very short period of time, so...
Yeah, it's true.
It wouldn't make sense for the characters to be like, you guys remember what happened way back 3 days ago? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the Narnia series, too. I guess you could jump in the middle, I don't know.
I like these comparisons, Sam.
Why? What are you saying?
Huh? Oh, I mean, grew up reading the Narnia series. They were like my, you know, fictional Bible. I really loved them, and Tolkien and all of these things.
Well, you know, it's funny because...
Really influential.
It's funny, in Narnia, you know, it's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but then if you go by C.S. Lewis's version, it's The Magician's Nephew that's first. That always intrigued me, too.
That's right, yeah.
Because I never looked at it that way, but, you know.
You don't have to listen to the author.
Well, the interesting thing about C.S. Lewis and Tolkien is that C.S. Lewis... love to write allegory, you know, which is basically what Narnia is, some kind of Christian allegory in Aslan and all that.
Right.
And he was trying to convince Tolkien that The Lord of the Rings was an allegory regarding the war. And that was when they had their great divide because Tolkien hated allegory. He hated the very concept of it, and the fact that his best friend labeled it that created this great schism between the two of them.
Hmm. Yeah, no, Tolkien had a very traumatic time during World War I, and I think he didn't want to, you know, be seen as a person who was psychoanalyzing himself through his books or something.
Yeah, no, he was very straightforward about things like that. And of course, the Hobbit was just, you know, a story to tell his kids too. And now I can't believe they're making 4 movies out of The Hobbit. It's just, you know, amazing to me. But
yeah,
and now there's
more to love.
Yeah. And now there's a Hobbit world in New Zealand, like Disney World.
Yeah, exactly. Are they making that? Well, sure, it's in New Zealand. You can go to Middle Earth.
Yeah, they have little, you know, round doors.
Go to Hobbiton.
Yeah, with round doors and knobs in the center. They probably
so cool.
They probably sell seed cakes.
Probably. I just went to Harry Potter's Wizarding World in Orlando, and that was kind of amazing. Really, well realized simulacrum of the Hogsmeade.
Yeah, I was there. Everything wasn't finished yet. Did you get butter beer?
Yes, delicious.
Was it good? I never had it.
Yeah, well, it's like butterscotch soda or something on ice. It's really good.
Yeah, it's funny how people do suggest things or interpret things, because I was talking to the woman who wrote The Scent of Pine. It just came out, Laura Vadier. And we were talking about the beginning of Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. And, you know, all my life I've said, you know, one morning Gregor Samsa awoke from troubling dreams to find himself transformed in his bed into a giant cockroach. And then I read that Vladimir Nabokov said it wasn't a cockroach, you know. It was vermin. It was a bug. And she and I both agreed that, you know, it has to be a cockroach. And it's just like we both agreed as readers that that's what it was going to be. And there was no two ways about it.
We have to go back to the original Polish and retranslate then.
Yeah, well, it translates apparently as vermin, so I'm screwed. But... So how do you feel about that, too? I know I asked you that time, like last time, about when you write a book, and especially now, and you're done with it, is it like, you know, taking your firstborn and saying, okay, you can go to school now and cross the street, but be careful, look both ways? Do you feel like, you know, you're giving it to the reader, but, you know, it's not yours anymore, it's the reader's to interpret, the reader's to second guess, like I did with your epigraphs just then?
Well, no, I think people can still be wrong. I don't always have to tell them, but yeah, there's a certain separation, you know, empty nest syndrome, I guess, for authors, when suddenly your book goes from being a thing that, like, your wife and your mom and your editor have read to something that, you know, anyone could read, which is it's an interesting shock to suddenly, even if people are saying nice things, to have people be reading your book at all and suddenly have opinions about it. It's sort of like, oh, it's not mine anymore, and not in the same way, at least.
Yeah, it's funny because the reviews, at least the ones I've read, have been uniformly, you know, glowing. And I was talking to one author, it might have been her, who said she likes to read bad reviews because it's much more fun to read bad reviews than it is to read good reviews.
That's an author who's not gotten any bad reviews. Don't read there's a big difference between, like, you know, bad reviews in reputable newspapers and bad reviews on, like, Amazon and Goodreads that are just savage.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know,
yeah. I think there was
pick
one.
Pick you apart for, like, minor things that you didn't even intend to do.
Yeah, well, that's
or might be misinterpreting you altogether. I hated the part about the weasel, and I'm like, it was the weasel.
And then they give it one star. Yeah, well, you know what that is. It's just...
Sometimes people are like, I thought it was pretty good, 2 stars. And I'm like, did they misclick? What's happening? You got to stay away from that stuff.
Yeah, I guess you do. I'll never know, but I guess you do. The thing about it is that what it really boils down to is people like the idea. Anybody, anywhere, it's the same. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And they feel like they have a certain amount of power over you at that moment.
Yeah. Well, Sam, I think I have another interview in a couple minutes.
Yeah, your publicist said, and then you got to catch a plane, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're keeping me busy.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, anyway, the book is great. First book is great. The graphic novel is great. And like I said, at the bookstore, everything's out front. So thanks for taking
Thank
the time.
You. Actually, that's great.
Yeah. And
it's really like booksellers, librarians and booksellers that make such a huge difference in the life of a book. So
I know.
Thank
thank you. And having an independent bookstore, although I never knew what a dependent bookstore was, you know, it's nice because everyone in our bookstore knows what your book is about. They can talk to the people who come in. Whereas if you go to, well, Barnes & Noble, you're not going to find the same kind of people that have this. You know, I've never hired anyone. They just fall into the bookstore. And
that's cool.
Oh, sorry, I'm doing this. Like, I end up talking all the time. I apologize. I know you got to go.
Not at all.
What? I am. You got to go. I'm talking too much.
No, you're not. Stop it.
Well, anyway,
it was great. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, and thanks for coming back again. And then when the third one comes out, will you come back and talk again about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Ransom.
Okay. Thank you, Sam.
So now we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we'll have the second of our shows, Sue Monk Kidd
and she'll be talking about the invention of wings, speaking tomorrow at the Free Library of Philadelphia at 7:30 p.m.
The Town Center Pharmacy in the Eagleview Corporate Center in Exton is a family-owned and operated pharmacy where you'll find them across the street from the Brickside Grill and the Eagleview YMCA. The Town Center Pharmacy is a one-stop shop for all your medical needs and more, from Band-Aids to wheelchairs and a lot more in between. The Town Center Pharmacy not only provides you with prescriptions at the same copay as other pharmacists, but also gives you individual attention and excellent service you simply will not get at large chain stores. Your relationship with your pharmacist is important, and that's why they make it a priority to provide nothing but the very best in professional service to their patients. By the way, the Town Center Pharmacy also offers free deliveries to all nursing homes. Call 610-458-3767 or visit them at 606 Wharton Boulevard in the Eagleview Corporate Center in Exton. Marketing and communications managers, are you getting eaten alive by the competition? Are you hungry for fresh creative ideas? Lion's Share Marketing can help your products and services roar above the competition and capture the attention of your target market. Their full-service boutique advertising agency staff of strategic thinkers and creative professionals is ready to take a bite out of your competition with effective and unique marketing solutions. Visit Lion's Share Marketing to learn how they can help you seize the lion's share of your market. That's spelled L-Y-O-N ShareMarketing.com or visit them in Exton's Eagleview Town Center at 562 Wharton Boulevard.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. This is Sam Hankin. The show is brought to you by my bookstore, Wellington Square Books. Today, we're lucky enough to have with us Sue Monk Kidd. You'll all remember Sue's first book, first novel, The Secret Life of Bees, was published in 2002. It was produced on stage, but in addition to a vast readership, you'll all remember it was adapted into an award-winning movie starring Dakota Fanning, Queen Latifah, Alicia Keys, among others. Her new book, The Invention of Wings, was released this January and has been selected for Oprah's Book Club 2.0. So welcome, Sue, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
You're welcome. What's great about this broadcast is that tomorrow night you'll be appearing right here in Philadelphia at the Free Library, correct?
That's right, and I'm really happy to be in Philadelphia. Actually, a great portion of my new novel is set in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I know, and it's funny because because I'm a Philadelphian, I can recognize when you're talking about Front Street, and I know what Market Street is. So I can almost place it in my mind as to where they are, which was really interesting for me. Why don't you? Because it just come out. Obviously, everyone in the world has read The Secret Life of Bees, but because your new book has just come out, The Invention of Wings, can you give our listeners a little brief summary of what the book's about?
The Invention of Wings is a historical novel based, or maybe I should say inspired by, the life of Sarah Grimke and her sister Angelina, who lived in Charleston, South Carolina in the 19th century. And I actually lived in Charleston for about 10 to 12 years and didn't even know of these two women who made amazing contributions to American history. They were the first female abolition agents in America and some of the earliest American feminist thinkers. They were incredible women, misbehaving women at that time, I guess you would say, because they spoke out of turn. So I was captivated by them and their lives, and decided to write a novel that would at least in part tell their story. It's also inspired by an enslaved woman who was in the household of the Grimkes. I felt like I had to tell both worlds. So I entwined the stories of Sarah Grimke and an enslaved woman named Hetty Handful, and it's about their quest for freedom, how they invented their wings, so to speak, the processes, the struggle, the courage that it took for them to do this. And it's also about their relationship over a course of 35 years, how they shaped each other's destinies.
Yeah, it was really interesting. well, there's so many things that are, but I really enjoyed reading about Sarah and Nina's relationship early on in their lives when Nina called Sarah her mother. And they were obviously so close, but then you make it clear, although, you know, a lot of this is fictionalized, and you talk about how you came about that, but it's interesting how Nina, in your viewpoint, was so beautiful, and yet Sarah was not unattractive, but plainer, and it was interesting the way you gave them the physical characteristics that you did, because you could really visualize it.
Well, in reality, you know, I'm not quite sure how that went. If you look at their pictures later in life, they were in Quaker garb, and they were typical somber-looking 19th century pictures. So we don't really have an image of them in their youth, but there were references that Angelina was quite dashing. So I played on that a good bit, and that actually Sarah was rather plain. There are hints of that. But I think the important aspect of their relationship as sisters, it was unusual, highly unusual relationship. As Sarah said, I was one wing, Angelina was the other. They were very different in many ways. Angelina being kind of brash and outspoken, Sarah being shy but a very deep thinker. And, you know, they made a perfect pair, and they took on the world together. They really did. And as Angelina said, they turned it upside down.
Do you think there's still room in the world now, you know, as in Oprah's notes and in your book, is there still room for women or for some other class of people that aren't treated the way they should be? Is there still room in this world today to invent your own wings?
Well, certainly I have to believe that as a writer and a person. I have to believe that. And to a large extent, the novel tries to address this issue at the very core of each person finding their own truth, their own courage, their own daring to voice themselves in the world and to make a difference. And this was what moved me about Sarah so much, was how desperately she wanted to make a difference in the world and to have a voice in things. And I think that impulse is in most everyone. And trying to set that free inside of us, I do think there is room for that, and there are still marginalized people that need to have their voice in the world.
It's interesting in your book, and it's a difficult process for the reader, a challenging one, and I think one which is worthwhile, to try to figure out who's good inherently, who's not so good inherently. And a perfect example of this would be Sarah's father, who is an amalgam of two different people, especially towards the end when he talks a little bit about how he treated Sarah earlier. Do you think Southerners who own slaves, do you consider their attitudes and how they treated the slaves, but then how they felt? Do you think there was this dichotomy in them?
I think there was a blindness in them. One of the things that was most disturbing and shocking to me as I did my research was just how invisible people could render slavery. You know, the first colony to legalize slavery, I believe, was Massachusetts. And so in the South, they were the last to let this go, doggedly holding on to it. So I think the invisibility of it there was terrible. I don't think everyone understood how evil, the banality of that evil even. But they were able to create these blind spots in their lives that were incredible. And I think this is something that humans have this strange ability to do, to deny and to look the other way or to make it okay that which facilitates our lives. And Sarah's father, I mean, to a large extent did that. He was both good and bad, as most people are. And in the end, he felt a great deal of remorse about it. I don't think this invisibility is in any way an excuse. I mean, slavery was an incredible and brutal evil, and how that could be allowed is inexcusable, really. So I think we have to, maybe this is one of the ways the novel might be relevant, is to raise the question of what is it in our lives today, you know, that we are not seeing? How does evil gather when we aren't looking?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because you have her father, who's extremely intelligent,
and a great judge, and has this beautiful library that initially Sarah has access to and then is denied. And then you also have people who initially respect and like Sarah, but once she and her sister come back down, the violence and the anger that they have is so incredible. Yet these are intelligent people. Just like today in government, you have intelligent people and you wonder how can they act the way they do when they have this great deal of intelligence.
Exactly. It is one of the stranger things about our species, isn't it?
It is. And it's funny because when you list your favorite books at the end of your book, you talk about Thomas Merton. And Thomas Merton wasn't the greatest guy until he changed his life. And I also read about how you or somebody considers you a contemplative Christian. And I feel that same way about Thomas Merton, who's one of my favorites. And I wonder how that, if at all, kind of informs the way you wrote. You ever think about that, perhaps?
Yeah, well, you know, that's somewhat of a new thought for me. There's no doubt that Thomas Merton was a huge influence in my life. When I read his autobiography, Seven Story Mountain, I was struck by, you know, the life he had lived earlier. I mean, a life of a lot of decadence, and yet he went through a profound conversion. So that gives me hope, really, for my characters, that we are never just one way. We're not all good or all evil or all right or all wrong. We are human. I mean, even Sarah, she had a great deal of righteousness and in some ways a little bit of self-righteousness. She was good, and yet she was slow to come to her moment. She lacked courage at times. She had failures. She struggled. I think, you know, it's like, I think it might have been Plato that said, or Plutarch, or one of those, you know, brilliant Greek thinkers who said, you know, we should just be kind to one another because we're all facing great battles. And maybe that's it, that as humans we just face many things and we struggle with them. I think some people try to work it out a little better than others, and some perhaps not, and there's the difference.
And for the reader, and why this is such a good book, is I remember the pivotal moment in the book where Sarah decided which way she was going to go, to me, and that was when she comes back home and Handful is in her fancy new bathtub, and Sarah is initially so angry, and then she realizes, wait a minute, she's my equal. Who am I to be? But that's a hard process for her at that moment, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. That was a defining moment in both of their lives. I saw that scene as the moment when Handful, who is just a girl, I mean, they're in their late adolescence at this point, declares herself. You know, she is, it is a baptism of her own worth. And Sarah recognizes something that, you know, we can love this idea of equality in the abstract, but when it really comes down to it in the way we live our lives,
right,
it becomes a completely different thing. And I wanted very much to show that disparity and that paradox.
It is a paradox because it's like Sarah's looking at Handful and thinking, how dare she? And then Handful's looking at Sarah going, hey, how dare you?
Yes, it was a very uneasy relationship, to say the least. And yet, despite the vast divide between them, Sarah being this white girl woman of privilege and Handful being an enslaved woman, despite all of that, they still found a way to have a relationship. And it was disturbed by so many things, from guilt to defiance. But in the end, I think they had what I would call a very uneasy, redemptive kind of sisterhood.
Yeah, it's like when something bad happens to Hetty and Sarah goes, I know exactly how you feel.
Yes.
And Hetty says, no, you don't.
Oh, really? Yes, hardly. Hardly.
One of the other defining moments, I think, is, and it was really well done, is when Sarah's
teaching the colored Sunday school, and she's singing the alphabet song, which in my head I was singing at the same time. And then she gets her comeuppance from the reverend, who says, "We don't sing songs in colored Sunday school." And she doesn't say anything. She just glares at him. She has an enormous amount of courage, even as a child.
Yeah, I think they learned from each other. You know, earlier in a scene, Hansel had done a similar thing to Sarah's mother in a very tense moment. And Sarah took a page from Hansel. They shaped each other's destinies. They changed one another's lives. And so you see that, I think, in that moment, yes.
Well, it's funny, Mary was there in the classroom, too. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about the idea of the Misses, or later on in the book, the Little Misses, what that was like in the South.
Yes. Well, I think Mary returned in the end to sort of pick up where Sarah's mother, known as the Misses, left off, and to carry that on with a new youthful vigor even. I believe there had to be this antagonistic force to be portrayed in some of these characters. And there was a meanness in this. Let's face it, there was a kind of casual cruelty and a meanness about how slaves were treated. I don't think I overplayed it at all. After reading the slave narratives of the 19th century and even the slave narratives from the 1930s, I was stunned by what took place, and I felt like I could not shy away from this, that I had to portray it as truthfully and as unflinchingly as I possibly could. And I think that was behind some of it, and yet it was also in the ordinary, just daily lives. Their lives were stolen, and I wanted the reader to feel what that might have been like.
Yeah, just the idea, almost viscerally, you could feel. And just the fact that Mrs. has this cane, and just the fact that she has the ability to take the tip of the cane and slap someone on the head with it. And you can almost feel it in your own head, but she didn't think twice about it. She thought she was doing a very nice thing and, to, you know, being very nice to her slaves.
Yes, again, the way we completely delude ourselves. In the deathbed scene with between Sarah's father and Sarah, you know, he confesses to her, "Do you think I didn't know somewhere inside of me that slavery was wrong?" And yet, it supported the entire way we lived. It would have, their whole lives were built on that. So they somehow made it okay in their head. Now, how they did that is a trick of the spirit. I don't know how they were able to do that. And yet, it happened over and over for 246 years in this country. We had slavery, and people were able to justify it, this kind of oppression. So it makes me feel that we can't be too lackadaisical about what we're doing today.
Yeah, it's this may not be relevant to the book, but I always, especially when you're thinking of Thomas Merton or contemplative Christianity, if you think back to Jesus on the cross and you have a thief on either side of him, one of whom doesn't give any credence to Jesus, and the other one who, I guess at the very last moments of his life, admits Jesus into his life, and Jesus says, "In 1 hour I will see you in heaven." And I wonder how you feel about the fact that her father, at the very, very end of his life, maybe not attempting to absolve himself, but denying what he did, not denying the righteousness of what he did and saying he was completely wrong. Do you think if you, at the very last moments of your life, you do that, you do have a change of heart, a true contrite change of heart, do you think that matters in terms of Christianity?
Well, I feel very ambivalent about that. I strongly feel that in forgiveness and in giving people second chances over and over, because goodness knows, we all make mistakes, and we all need that. At the same time, it feels like a little too little too late, in a way, doesn't it? I mean,
yes.
You spend your life investing in this, in slavery, and then at the very end saying, "Well, you know, I was wrong, and I'm sorry, and I feel remorse." it seems a little too easy. So I have a lot of ambivalence about all of that, and I just think that we just have to take note of this as a cautionary thing for ourselves.
When I was reading the book, part of me was upset that this was all in the early 1800s, because I wanted to see the fruit of what Sarah and Angelina had done. But then I realized that there had to be women who laid the foundations for what later came. I wanted them to see the results of what they did, but they were too early on, and that kind of made me feel sad for them.
Well, I try to comfort myself by realizing that they did at least see the end of slavery. You know, they did not see women get the vote. They did not see the culmination of so much of that, which is sad. But they, I think, were at least able to feel that they had done their part. But there, yes, you're right. There's a bit of disappointment in that they didn't live long enough to see this come around for them.
Yeah, it's also telling, again, that when they split, or when they talked, and when they talked and added the idea of women's rights along with the abolition of slavery, how the men that were close to them were aghast and made it very difficult for them to proceed in that fashion.
Well, that was part of the great conflict that set off the spark for women's rights. And, of course, Sarah and Angelina were carrying the banner for that, because they were the ones that pretty much attached slavery to women's rights and to that whole issue. And so they became entwined. In a way, they were entwined. Gender and race were entwined forms of slavery in some ways, as many people have written, including Sarah. And they were able to bring that to the forefront. And, of course, you know, people didn't like that. It stirred up an enormous amount of controversy.
Especially when they came back to town, or kind of ridden out of town on a rail, and in a very interesting last scene, which I certainly won't talk about, but an amazing one, and one that, you know, really gave you, it was a nice uplifting way to end the book.
Well, I wanted it to end with both realism and hope. So that was my aim, and I think people might find it somewhat uplifting.
And you did leave it, well, I don't want to talk about the end of it, but I really feel that you gave this book to the reader, and I don't know if you felt like when you were finished you were giving away your child, but the idea is that, especially with the end, you know, you leave the reader to decide what's going to happen, or to think about what's going to happen, or to contemplate what's going to happen. I think that's always good in a book, don't you?
I do. I think it is the reader who's going to live this story forward, and I gave them a way to live that forward in the best way possible, I think.
And you did.
I hope so.
It was a great book. And in closing, I just want to tell you that, you know, I do own an independent bookstore. Your book is already there on the front table and in the window. And, you know, our book club selection some years ago was The Secret Life of Bees. And I'm sure, if not already, we have that. We have The Invention of Wings on our schedule as a book club pick. And we have our own book club in the store. And there's probably several others that we host that will also be choosing your book. So I just wanted to let you know that we really do appreciate you.
Well, thank you for that. It's terrific to know that. I'm pretty grateful for my readers, you can't imagine. So, and booksellers.
Yeah, and it's very difficult. It has to be kind of a labor of love to keep the bookstore going,
because
it's especially with Kindles and with Amazon and with online purchasing and all that. But in any event, I'll be down there tomorrow night, and hopefully all of our listeners, or a good portion of them, will be down at the Free Library tomorrow night when Sue will be talking about her new book, The Invention of Wings. And I assume you'll be signing as well.
I will be signing, yes.
I'll try and sneak in there and say hello to you.
Oh, good. I'd like that.
Thanks, Sue, so much, and thanks for bringing us such a wonderful book as well.
You're very welcome, and thank you, too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Avid Reader, kind of a double edition. We talked to both Ransom Riggs and we talked to Sue Monk-Kidd. The reason I doubled it up is because Ransom Riggs will be speaking tonight at the Free Library at 7:30, and tomorrow night Sue will be talking at the Free Library as well. So I figured I'd give you guys a heads up
You should all head down there. It's a wonderful venue and a wonderful place to have your books signed. And you get a chance to see the Free Library of Philadelphia. And next week, we will be joined by Gary Steingart, who wrote Little Failure. He's a Jewish-Russian emigre who's a really hilarious guy. Look him up on YouTube, and especially look up the trailer for the book Little Failure. He'll be with us next week talking about his memoir, Little Failure. His name is Gary Steingart. So, as always, thanks very much for joining us, especially on this special edition of The Avid Reader, and we hope you'll be with us next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.